And welcome to our podcast, Manage Your Money God's Way. We're from Compass Catholic Ministries. Our mission is to teach you what the Bible tells us are the best practices for handling money. You heard me, the Bible. It's our workbook. Over 2,500 verses in the Bible deal specifically how God wants all of us to handle money. And we teach these principles in our small group Bible study called Faith and Money Matters. And you can get a preview of that Bible study simply by going to compasscatholic.org, click on Books and Studies, and look up Faith and Money Matters. My name is Steve Holbrook, and with me are the co-founders of Compass Catholic Ministries, John and Evelyn Bean. Well, today the discussion is all about your favorite thing, taxes. Now, you know, some people will comment about taxes as not being biblical, especially if they don't agree with what the government is doing today. But remember in Mark chapter 12, verse 17, so Jesus said to the Pharisees, repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God. So whether or not we like the current administration or agree with what's going on in Washington, as citizens, we have an obligation to pay taxes. However, as good stewards, we should follow all legal methods of reducing our tax burden by not overpaying. So today, John and Evelyn are going to spend some time with Matt Marcoux about following the rules while paying the minimum that we're required to pay as regards to taxes. Matt is a financial advisor with Candor Path here in Central Florida, and Matt also specializes and very knowledgeable in the field of taxes.
John and Evelyn, thank you so much for having me. I'm such a big fan of what you guys are doing with Compass Catholic, and it's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me, especially during this time of the year where we end up having a lot of tax questions in my practice. I oftentimes say the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion is the thickness of a prison wall. We want to make sure that whatever we're doing, we are doing in the most ethical, legal way possible. And so I'm looking forward today to providing your guests with some answers to some questions they might have.
Well, thank you. We're excited that you're here. You know, one of the things, Matt, that we get a lot of time is we work with people who are really struggling financially, but they're so excited when they get a big tax return at the end of the year, and it's hard to convince them why that's not a good idea. So can you talk to us about that a little bit?
That's a great question. I get this all the time as well. I think a lot of it comes down to a lack of planning. You know, at the end of the day, when someone gets a large refund, that just tells me that there was no thought given or there was less thought given at the beginning of the year when their earnings began on what their tax rate might be at the end of the year or what their tax bill might be at the end of the year. You need to be really intentional about taxes. That's oftentimes something people don't think about till April 14th. And that's the worst time to do it because at that point in time, it's too late. Right. So tax planning really starts at the beginning of the year. And that's where I really think spending time with either looking at your previous year's income and determining what the next year looks like will help you avoid both a big tax bill and also a big refund coming back. Because at the end of the day, you are giving the government a tax-free loan during that year. And that money can just be used in so many other more productive ways other than just having it sit in the coffers of the IRS or U.S. Treasury in this case.
Part of the problem is something that we face all the time is that people don't know how much they spend. Some of them don't even know how much they make, to be perfectly honest, or what their, maybe better said, they don't know what their take-home is. But we've talked to people who were really excited because they counted on getting a $7,000 or $8,000 check in May after they filed their taxes. And they used that to pay all kinds of bills that had accumulated because they didn't have enough money during the course of the year to cover those bills. So let's talk a little bit about how the government handles the money and what happens when you actually get, you know, a $7,000 or $8,000 check as a tax return.
Your money is growing at 0% pretty much when it's held by the IRS. And so if you think about it this way, this term that we throw around, a tax-free loan to the government, is really what occurs from the moment you begin withholding from your paycheck to the moment that you file for your taxes, either in February, March, or April. What we find, though, is that money, as you mentioned, can be used in such a better way, whether it's paying off the debt or whether it's adding money to your retirement plan. You know, we're not going to get into a conversation today about investments, but this last year was a very good year in terms of investments for a multitude of reasons. And that money that would, could have been put inside your 401k really could have had a lot of opportunities to grow. And so that opportunity cost is what we find is the biggest issue when someone gets a large refund back. That money could have just been used in such a better way than having it sit at the IRS.
So do you have a key phrase that you use to convince people that what they're doing is not in their best interest?
Yeah, I think oftentimes by being very intentional about the planning that we do, taxes come up in every single one of our meetings. And as a certified financial planner, that's one of the core competencies that we have. And so even if someone's really not even thinking about that, that's something we must bring up in a meeting. This will probably go into more detail when we start talking about some of the changes that occurred this year that forces a lot of our clients to talk about what is happening on their own taxes because they need to adjust to the changes that took place both in 2017 and 2020.
So what are some of those changes?
You know, 2017, there was a lot of tax changes, and the biggest of which was the reduction or elimination of a personal exemption. Prior to 2017, you got a personal exemption for every person, including yourself and your household. That personal exemption is also what was used to figure out how much taxes you should have withheld. So when you went to your employer and you filled out your W-4, the tax form used to illustrate how much withholding you want, you would put down how many exemptions are in your household, how many people are in there that you're getting a tax deduction for. Well, when exemptions were eliminated, that really caused a void in the tax withholding calculation, because now we didn't have a real good metric to determine what do we use to figure out how much taxes are going to be at the end of the year. Well, in the infinite wisdom of the Internal Revenue Service, at the beginning of 2020, they gave a new form to everyone. And this new W-4 form basically asks you all of your personal questions regarding your finances and your spouse's income that you now need to give to your employer. Now, think about this from your standpoint. You might have a spouse that has a higher income level than you, or you might have investments that are generating a lot of, do you want your employer to know about those numbers? Maybe you're an open book and it's no big deal, but I have a really hard time with my clients divulging all of their personal information to their employer in order to get an accurate depiction of how much tax they should have withheld.
But there's really no choice in the matter, is there?
Well, there is. You can divulge all of this to your employer. You can go online to the IRS website and fill out your own form and try to figure this out yourself. Or you can come to work with a financial advisor. Let's see, how can I put this in the most? Work with a financial advisor who will help you make those determinations. And that's what the first 2 weeks of this year really is for us in our office, is helping our clients make sure that they have enough taxes withheld.
My process has been to come out net zero when it comes to tax time. I don't owe any money and I don't get any money back. And the closer I get to zero, the happier, I am. I was looking at the new W-4 form, and it just doesn't seem very clear to me how you can accomplish that.
It is the government's fault, but it's not. So at the end of the day, really to determine how much taxes you need to have withheld, you really do need to look at your entire financial picture to determine that. That's how we did it in the past. Mm-hmm. This whole exemptions that you talked about, we would first figure out what the client's tax look like, a pro forma tax return for the next year. Then we would have them adjust those exemptions up or down, wait for the next paycheck to come out, and see if that number matched what you should have withheld. We still do that to this day. But it's a pretty complex calculation. And if you're doing this on your own, that's not an easy situation to be in. So I completely understand. And nowadays, it's going to be even more complex.
You were talking about the new W-4 form. Does everybody have to fill out a new form, or do the old ones just stay in place unless you fill out a new one?
The old one will stay in place. The same amount withheld from the previous year will continue on. But what we noticed at the end of last year when we were filing some taxes is that people who were expecting either refund or expecting O, those numbers were drastically different because of the way the government changed the withholding schedule. So not only do you have your withholding up or down, but the government also has a set schedule that they do withholding for. And it really made, for lack of a better word, chaos last year when filing our taxes. And so hopefully this year we'll make things a little bit smoother in that we can determine a much more refined picture of what the tax rate looks like for each person.
Does the fact that they increased the standard deduction for a family that is filing married jointly has a standard deduction of $24,000 or $24,800?
$24,800 this year, yeah.
Yeah. And in the past, in order to get those kinds of numbers, you had to do an itemized deduction on Schedule A and list your giving and all the other things, the property tax and the sales tax and all that kind of stuff. Does the fact that now they've got this big number that hardly anybody is going to reach with their own personal Schedule A, does that make things easier or not?
Well, the government giveth and the government taketh away, if that's a word. So so what I mean by that is that everyone got that increase in the standard deduction, but they also eliminated personal exemptions, as we talked about earlier in the show. So, again, a family of four would have had four deductions for personal exemptions. Well, that went to zero. There's no more personal exemptions. So in order to combat that, I guess the thought process was give everyone a larger standard deduction, less people have to try to come up with all of the different deductions for it. And so some of that was meant to, I guess, level out the playing field. But I got to tell you, some families of four were really hurt by that because they were itemizing in the past. They had the same standard, same itemized deductions. But now they lost all the exemptions for maybe their two kids or whatever dependents are in there. Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, to answer your question, is yes, that's helped a little bit, having the doubling of the standard deduction, but it wasn't without losing something at the same time.
What does a family do if they have excessive deductions?
Well, remember, they didn't take away the standard deduction. They just doubled it. So I still have clients that itemize to this day. Even though the standard deduction is $24,800 this year for a married filing, couple finally married, we still have people who might have been going through some major medical issues that still can itemize. They might have interest on their home or tax in the state that they live in. They could have a large number of charitable deductions. So there still is the possibility for itemizing, but that number came way down with the tax law change.
Mm-hmm. So if you still want to do it, you can. You don't have to use the standard.
You certainly can, absolutely.
It makes it much harder to meet the threshold.
It does.
Especially since they eliminated several of the, in our case, they eliminated things that really jumped that number up pretty high, like fees for financial planners.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah, all of that went away. And what we saw as a byproduct of it is, and again, I would have to talk to some more charitable organizations of this, but I'm curious to see if there has been a decline in charitable giving, because while some people have that charitable heart and would have done it under any circumstance, for those that are no longer getting that tax deduction because they're going to itemize, are charities still receiving those same amount of donations or givings? And so I'm really curious to see what the outcome of that happens to be at some point down the road.
Actually, based on what I've been reading, charitable giving has gone up. Now, that doesn't mean it hasn't gone up drastically, but it has gone up a couple of percent.
Well, and it's caused us to be a little bit more, and I know we're kind of going off on a tangent, but it caused us to be a little bit more thinking outside the box when our clients are doing their givings, on making sure they're doing it not only in the right way, but also the most tax advantage way. And so again, we've thought of at least two ways that are kind of outside the box for our clients to make sure that they're still giving that same amount and getting this, maybe not the same deduction, but at least some sort of a credit against their taxes.
So what are those two ways?
So the two ways, and again, these are not new, but they're just ones that we're leaning on more heavily now that the itemized deductions have doubled. But the first is giving appreciated stock. So again, if a client of ours has a stock that is significantly appreciated, instead of them paying the capital gains tax on that stock, they can gift that stock to a charitable organization. That charitable organization can sell that stock and not have any capital gains on it. It's the same net to our clients, except they got rid of a potential tax liability.
Well, and actually, if they're not having to pay the capital gains tax, they can give a few more shares that would have been equal to what they would have had to pay in taxes. So it actually would allow them to increase their giving.
Absolutely. And I 100% agree with that. You have to make sure that the charitable organization has the proper way to receive that. And I've run into that issue a few times as well, especially with smaller organizations. But once you've overcome that hurdle, it's a great way to give. The second way is by making a qualified distribution out of your IRA and doing so for clients that at the time were over age 70 and a half. Over age 70 and a half, you needed to, in the past, take a required minimum distribution out of your IRA. If you routed that money away from you and towards the charitable organization, it counted as you still took the money out of the IRA, so you satisfied the requirement, but now the charitable organization receive that. Now, some changes have taken place there, so it's not the same numbers as previous, and we'll talk about that.
What would you think is probably the number one issue with your clients when you start talking about taxes?
I think it goes back to the beginning of our conversation. It is a lack of planning. Everything in your finances need to be planned out. That's what I do for a living, is I plan.
You're speaking our language, Matt. We love it.
So if there is intentionality, if there's planning there, then there really should be maybe not no surprises, but the surprises should be somewhat limited. Yeah. Having a tax analysis done at least twice a year at the beginning to make sure you're on the right track, and then towards the end of the year to make sure that there has been no surprises that might have popped up, that inheritance that might have come in, or selling a property or an asset. If you're being very intentional about those things, there really should be very few surprises that pop up. And so, again, that's one of the areas that we really stress to our clients.
So have the tax brackets changed for the 2019 tax year, or are they changed for the 2020 tax year?
Yes, they have. And that's something we kind of see typically, you know, each year, every other year, there's a cost of living adjustment. There's seven tax brackets now. IRS.gov does a great job of actually breaking those out and showing where each income level is for your particular situation.
So if you're on the bubble, you're in the lowest tax bracket, and you're on the bubble of just getting to that next higher tax bracket, is there something you can do to remain in the lower tax bracket? Are there things you can do toward the end of the year or planning now to not increase your taxes?
We have a progressive tax rate in the United States. So switching over from one bracket to another really isn't necessarily a large leap. Where it does impact you in times is if you have a capital gains, but that's probably something for another day. But for the most part, if you want to reduce your tax bracket or your taxable income, there are a number of ways for you to do that. The most popular ways are for either doing a employer-sponsored retirement plan, a 401k through your work, or some sort of simple IRA or SEP, depending on what your employer has. Or at the end of the day, just doing an IRA contribution if your income limits allow that. You can do an HSA, which is health savings account, use your flex spending. So there's a lot of ways you can do it. Again, it all comes down to planning.
And so, those things ultimately are to your benefit. I mean, they may lower your taxes in the short term, but in the long term, they're benefiting you financially too.
Sure. Who doesn't need additional money in their health savings account because of medical expenses?
One of the things that we do, and I think it's probably a good practice, at least it's worked for us, okay? I would like to kind of talk about that with you, is at the beginning of the year, we calculate what our total income is going to be. It's getting easier and easier because it's getting lower and lower. But, you know, I figure out, well, over 12 months, this is how much I'm going to earn. Over 12 months, this is how much Evelyn's going to earn. And this is the total. And based on years past, I know what our deductions are going to be. Or in the case of the increased exemption, you know, you subtract $24,000. I think for a lot of people, they never reach $24,000. So that's a benefit to them. And then you can subtract that from your income, and that figures it pretty much pretty closely to what your AGI is, adjusted gross income, which is what the taxes are based on. You can go to the tax brackets, IRS.gov that you mentioned, and take a look at where that AGI falls in, whether it's 12% or 22% or wherever. You do that at the beginning of the year, and then at the 1st of October, when you still have some time to make corrections, not this December 31st, but 1st of October, you go back and do that same thing, but now you've got 75% of it in real time, and so you're only forecasting 3 months' worth, and then you can make adjustments that way. Does that sound like a solid practice for people to begin the process of planning? I mean, for some people, it's going to be quite a chore because they have no idea, but...
Absolutely, John. I think that's a great idea. I think the problem is life gets in the way oftentimes. Think of a family of four, husband and wife. They're working, busy. They have a couple of children. They're busy with activities. The last thing that they really want to think about is that tax question. And so, you know, really having the ability to either outsource that question to somebody else, I think, is really critical, especially in this day and age. But if nothing else, then yes, going on, figuring out what your income is. And maybe there hasn't been a drastic change, but there could have been some major tax changes, as you talked about. The changing of the standard deduction, that probably impacted a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so that's why we either saw some happy people, or we heard about some happy people at the end of the year, and some not happy people, because they might have either gotten that big bill, or they've gotten, you know, a large refund that they didn't really intend on getting. So, it's all about being intentional.
So I've got a question. I heard about the new 1040 SR form. What is that all
1040
about?
1040 SR. So the 1040.
That's not for the 2019 tax year. That's for the 2020 tax year.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a senior form. It's not really widely used these days. It's primarily used by maybe someone doing a hand filing. You need to be over age 65. In the past, there were some income limitations to being able to use it, and now there's not. But it's just not as a robust tax form as what most people are typically used to.
How many people file their taxes themselves by hand? You know, send in that paper copy that they've put a pencil to and an eraser to.
Yeah, I've seen a lot come through my office, and the moment that I see the pages come in with handwritten pencil on them, I immediately go over to the software and start plugging numbers in and then letting our computer systems do the calculations instead of us with a slide ruler.
There's a new tax law that got passed in December. It was kind of hidden into the government funding bill that the president signed. And it's called SECURE, I believe. I forget what those letters stand for, but one of the big changes I know is that the RMDs, the required minimum distributions that you used to have to take when you reach 70 and a half years old, now don't have to be taken until you reach 72.
Finally, and I think a whole number.
The half year got eliminated.
Yes.
So
thank goodness, because what a pain it was to calculate when someone turns 70 and 6 months old, amongst all the other things that we have to do in our practice. That was not an easy process to figure. Oh, it was, but it was a pain. So yes, I'm very happy that they used a whole number this time and not 72 and three quarters or some other type of decimal. But yes, that was one of the largest changes that took place. Now, it does impact those who are not age 70 and a half already. So if you've been taking your required minimum distribution because you have already reached age 70 and a half, that process needs to continue. If you had not reached age 70 and a half, the new number now is age 72. So it gives you some additional time to continue letting your IRAs, 401ks grow and accrue. And then at that point in time, you'll begin making those distributions out of that account.
So what the government's really trying to do is get you to increase your savings as much as possible, so that when they start taking it, they're going to get more.
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, it was because everyone's living longer, supposedly, but I like your answer better. That made more sense to me.
What's that cartoon with the tax form? How much did you make?
Send it in.
So that was one of the biggest changes. The other big change that took place is that if anyone has ever inherited an IRA, and this is a biggie as well, if you inherited an IRA from a family member other than your spouse, that money, you needed to make a required minimum distribution, and that used to be able to be done over the course of your lifetime. So if you were young, you had a long time to go, you made little distributions out of this inherited IRA that you had. The new tax law compresses that into 10 years. So you now have 10 years to make sure that money comes out. So this stretch provision that was so popular for so many years has all but essentially gone away, and you now have to compress that into a shorter period of time.
So it has to be totally eliminated in 10 years.
It does.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a biggie, especially if a young child is inheriting an IRA or something like that. It changes our planning techniques quite a bit. And again, it's all about being intentional.
Well, Matt, we really appreciate you coming in and spending some time with us, educating us a little bit about taxes and about the new ways that we've got to begin to use. And so we just really appreciate you being here. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evelyn. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
One thing that is certain, we definitely need to have Matt back come fall so everyone listening will be prepared and fully understand whether they have been paying too much in taxes or not enough. If you'd like to hear this show again, it's available to you on demand at compasscatholic.org. Just click on podcast and look for Understanding Your Tax Situation. And before we get out of here today, let's answer a few emails that we received this week. All right, John and Ellen, here we go. My son is 31 years old and has never had a credit card or a car loan. He's now in the need of a car loan but cannot get one because he has no credit. What can he do to build his credit that will enable him to get a car loan or a mortgage down the line?
It's interesting that a 31-year-old doesn't have any credit established, but it's good that he's not asking and you're not offering to co-sign for the loan, because that is a no-no in our world.
One way that he could establish some credit is to obtain a secured credit card. What that means is that he would put $500 or $1,000 in the bank and then use the credit card against that money that he deposited towards the credit card. That's one way he can establish credit. He can't ever go beyond what he's got money in the bank. It's just like having a checking account. You can't write checks for what you don't have, because they're not going to get cashed.
And if he's serious about buying a car, he should start saving the money now that he would be paying on a car payment, so he has a larger down payment when it comes time to actually purchase the car.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, John and Evelyn, I love seeing questions like this one. We want to begin budgeting, but we don't know where to start. And then in capital letters, she has help.
Starting a budget can be difficult because if you don't know where you're actually spending money now, all you're doing is pulling numbers out of thin air. So the best place to start if you're trying to start a budget is to track every penny you spend to see where your money's actually going.
And then after you've done that for 30 or 60 days, it's time to build a budget. And you have a starting point to do your budget based on what your actual spending was. There are tracking sheets available on compasscatholic.org. If you go to the resources page, you will find them.
And if you have a question or two for John and Evelyn, by all means, send those to ask@compasscatholic.org. For John and Evelyn Bean and from our guest, Matt Marcoux from Candor Path, we thank you so much for joining us. Remember, we have a brand new podcast available for you each and every Wednesday morning. Simply go to compasscatholic.org. On the homepage, hit podcast, and there you have it. This is Manage Your Money God's Way. We're from Compass Catholic Ministries.